On April 13...
Trust.
You're going to tell me about the history of the Urban League in relation to its present function. Is that right?
Yes. The role of the importance of the Urban League, Mr. Warren, is only understood if one recognizes at the outset that the solution to the problem of race relations involves many courses of action, that this is not a monolithic problem, and there needs to be, therefore, a variety of activities. The Urban League conceives of itself as working toward the same goal, and that it supplements and complements the activities of all other organizations, that we are the organization that will give meaning to the slogans Equal Opportunity or Freedom Now, in that first-class citizenship is more than the removal of barriers, it's more than the establishment of new laws, it's more than the right to go in a restaurant or into a neighborhood. Also involved is the necessity to have the resources in terms of qualification, in terms of economics, in order to take advantage of new opportunities. So the Urban League in this sense is the, we are the social engineers, we are the strategists, we are the planners, we are the people who work at the level of policy making, policy implementation, with the highest echelons of the corporate community, the highest echelons of the governmental community, both at federal, state, and local level, the highest echelons of the labor movement. In terms of the providing them with the necessary facts, we do the research, we're the professional arm. You'd have to understand that the Urban League, unlike the other organizations, is a professional organization. We have some 525 full-time staff. 350 of these are professional people with their master's degrees and over, working in full-time in some 65 communities around the country, where 85% of the urban Negro population lives. We have some 13 leagues in the South and 52 in the North, all in urban settings. Each of these organizations, affiliates, like the National Board, must, under its constitution, be interracial. And increasingly, the staff reflects that same philosophy. But the boards throughout the country are composed about 50-50 of responsible white and Negro citizens who meet on a monthly or even every other week basis in order to discuss and to resolve some of the basic problems.
This leads us to a fundamental difference between your organization and some others, and between your philosophy and some other philosophies of these matters. Let me read you just a quote, may I?
Yeah.
It's a question in relation to the white man. This is a summary in a forthcoming book on race relations. I'll read the quote from it and we'll see whether it makes sense, whether it makes sense or not. In Baldwin, James Baldwin's Cosmology, in fact, there seems to be no decent white of any sort, and no way a white man can prove his decency. If you are hostile, you're a racist. If you express friendship or sympathy, you're a fuzzy liberal, a part of the course of innocence. If you cannot, if you commit yourself to action, this merely proves that you are condescending toward the Negro to purge your own conscience. Well, you see the line. Now,
yes,
I
see the line, and my analysis would differ a slight bit. First of all, I think that neither white people nor Negro people have any monopoly on virtue or on vices. My analogy of this situation is that the present plight of Negro citizens, and that plight is really a very serious one, results not so much from historic ill will or goodwill, but actually what we've had in our society is about 10% of white Americans who have been actively concerned and who've been actively working toward integration, about 10% who've been actively resistant, who have worked to preserve the status quo or to even send the Negro back to Africa. But about 80% of white Americans have been largely indifferent. This has been active apathy, active indifference. So it hasn't been ill will or goodwill, it's been no will that is largely responsible. This is characteristic of Americans. We tend to focus on the pleasant and the beautiful and the gay and to push in the subconscious that is ugly and unpleasant, particularly if we feel some responsibility for it. So what's happened largely is that white Americans have ignored the Negro. They have not taken the Negro seriously. They have driven around the slums. They keep their heads buried in the Wall Street Journal as a commuter train stops at 125th Street. And this is a significance, it seems to me, of the Negro Revolution, say, of 63, is that all America was forced to look at the Negro. There was a confrontation for the first point in the lives of many people. And this is why 64 becomes a year of decision-making. We had assumed up till now that good race relations meant the absence of tension and conflict, and not the presence of justice and equal opportunity. I don't think that anybody can generalize about all whites being this or all Negroes being this. Obviously, now that we all confront it, many white people will find themselves out of fear and insecurity and ignorance, identifying themselves more with the races. They'll vote for Wallace. But I think increasingly, white America, when it's confronted with the grim realities, with the tragic consequences to their indifference, with the threats to their way of life, with the inhumane kind of consequences that result from indifference in considering race relations a spectator sport, will find themselves on the right side. But I'm not distressed by the unrest, the tensions, by the conflict. I think this in many ways is healthy because it's bringing the real attitudes and feelings to the surface where we can deal with them. It's like a boil. You make a decision about whether you put a Band-Aid over it and act like it doesn't exist, or whether you lance it. Temporarily it doesn't look good, but this is the only way of getting at the roots and bringing about some change. And historically, Americans have only reacted to crises, and they've only fixed a bridge when it fell in. Or there was an accident at the corner, and they put up a stoplight.
Taking that two ways from this point, in the past, at least there's one historical theory that says this, Negro gains have come as byproducts of national crises of one kind or another. But this brings on now, in the last few years, a great drive on the part of Negroes to separate the present, quote, revolution or movement, or whatever we should call it, from this byproduct status in history.
I wouldn't say this entirely. I think we can attribute this heightened impatience, this accelerated kind of aspiration of the Negro directly to a number of historical forces. I think we can attribute it directly in part to the mobility of Negroes as made necessary by World War II, where Negroes were taken out of the South, and for the first time in their lives, they traveled throughout the world. They saw how they got a taste of freedom, taste of what it meant to be a man. They found out that their lives did not have to be lived in misery and abuse. I think the increased and perfected system of communications, which immediately throwed on the screen what was happening throughout the world. I think the increased education of Negroes, I think the Cold War, the competition between America and Russia, America attempting to provide moral world leadership, was forced to commit itself publicly over and over to a certain concept of democracy and freedom that did not go unheard by the masses of Negro people. I think the emergence of African nation into independence and their subsequent receptions in America by the highest government officials, their appearance on television frequently at the UN, gave to Negroes a new sense of destiny, a new pride in race. It made them shake off their any feelings of inferiority. This, I think, all led up to, say, the incident in Montgomery with Mrs. Rosa Parks, where she sat on the bus for reasons even she cannot tell you now. And Montgomery led up to Tuskegee. And the sit-ins are a direct result of the inability of the power structure to absorb the increasing number of intelligent Negroes. As long as it could absorb them into dependent positions, they could control them and handle them. But you begin to get more. But I don't think that this can be separated from certain larger forces that were at work in the total society that contributed.
There are a lot of ideas that come in here, and I'm going to hack back to the first one we started with. It's the conception among Negroes, or conceptions, because I'm sure it's not one, of the role of the white man in this matter. We have all sorts of pronouncements, you see, of course. Like Miss Hansberry is announcing, you know, who was it with the burning house, dismiss this middle-class American civilization, and do what is it after that, you see? Or the black Muslim view, or Baldwin's statements, or the statement, you know, farewell to liberals, all of these. You're in a special position because your organization has been committed to a cooperation of a special kind, even more positive than the NAACP. And this, this puts you in a crucial position, your organization, in a crucial position about the what can the white man find to relate to in terms of this?
Well, I think this is a very basic question. Let me say first that it is quite true that the Negro today no longer conceives of his goal in life as simply a replication of the white society. That he is at this point viewing a bit more discriminately white America as to whether or not this in toto is what he wants to adopt as the best way of life. He is conceiving of integration now more as a synthesis rather than as a complete dropping of all that is Negro and the adoption of all that is white. What he's saying in effect is that all that is white is not good. It couldn't be good, or else we wouldn't have been kept in slavery and suppressed all these years. That there must be some moral bankruptcy here somewhere. There must be some value orientations that are not proper and good. He's saying that I think that I can bring something to a new society, even though I cannot bring certainly a superior technological know-how. Certainly I can't bring the money. I can't bring, in many cases, the same level of education. But out of suffering one develops something, and it goes beyond just jazz and music. One develops a compassion, one develops a humaneness, one develops a, certainly the Negro has developed a tolerance, a patience, that maybe the larger society can use. Maybe General Motors can use some of our compassion. And what we're saying is that we...
Don't be a dreamer.
Yeah. What we're saying is we would really like to... first of all, we don't like the implication that what is black is bad and what is Negro is bad, and the only way to be right is to be white. Now,
may I cut you in there?
Yeah.
Black equals bad, white equals good. I talked not long ago with a very distinguished Negro lawyer who said to me in a burst of passion, I have disciplined myself now to retranslate the imagery, the symbolism of the white world. White values, the bright light, learning all these symbols. And I reverse them. And then one remembers that these symbolisms are not American. Even African dances, you will find the figure representing good with a white robe and the figure representing evil with a black robe. Or in Chinese, the chalked face and the charcoal face in these matters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so it's not merely a cultural difference. Now, how does one deal with this fact? How does a Negro deal with this fact and say it's not a white man's trick, you see, to put these simple?
Yeah, I would think it's childish to reduce this, a kind of immaturity to reduce this purely to I'm going to reverse and call black good and white bad. I think what we are most concerned today about is white as being a symbol not of a race, but of a kind of character and value system and a kind of maturity. I think what we're fighting against isn't so much making white bad as not making black bad. And what we are working toward is a society where we lift the positives out of both cultures, reject the negatives, and we can find negatives in both cultures, and move toward a new society that is much better than either of the old. You see, I have a theory that with work and with thought, if we can change state of seeking, and if we can change conformity, at least we can change the norms to which people are conforming. And we can change the symbols that represent status. And instead of exclusiveness, as it relates to a neighborhood or a school or a business, exclusiveness being good, that we can change that and make inclusiveness positive. We can somehow get people to see that only the hopelessly insecure and inadequate person needs to surround themselves with sameness.
Don't you find the same problem among Negroes about the exclusive?
But it's a different reason. The Negro who chooses, yeah,
the fact,
and the Negro who chooses or who will say that he prefers to be in the all-Negro setting, either housing or in his social companies, is saying this out of a fear that he will not be accepted in the other. It's a defense where the white person is saying, I want this because I think it represents superiority and exclusiveness.
Let's take it a little farther. When Miss Hansberry or in Baldwin or when others say, white liberals stay away, we are running this show. See?
What do you...
This is exclusiveness. The white man we don't want to integrate with because take it as far as a black Muslim or take it as far as people are quoted.
Well, I think this is unfortunate.
It's true, though.
No, but
it's one element that we have to deal with.
You have to deal with it, but one of the tragedies in this whole civil rights struggle is the inability of the white person to distinguish leadership. for example, any Negro who achieves a certain amount of popularity or prominence, whether it's a Cassius Clay or a baseball player, Willie Mays, immediately, you see, when he utters something about the race relations problem, he is treated and thought of as an expert. The analogy to this was to ask Primo O'Connor, you know, or Tony Galinto, what do you think about foreign policy? To ask Mickey Mantle. I think we ought to keep in perspective here that while Lorraine Hansberry is a very gifted playwright, and while Baldwin is a very gifted writer, these are not people who, either in by their experiences, or by their training, or by their whole emotional orientation, by any means leaders of the Negro Revolution. They are people who describe it, who react to it, who write about it, but who themselves are not people equipped to suggest strategy, to interpret the social implications. And again, it reflects the lack of contact that the average white person has. The only Negroes that some white people know are the popular entertainers, writers, athletes. And so they are pretty much a victim, a beneficiary, as the case may be, of that person's interpretation. Now, it must be remembered that when the struggle was really hard and tough, Baldwin couldn't take it, left the country. He wasn't even here. There are many of these people who are now able to write about it and make a wonderful living on it. But let's not confuse this with leadership. You see, Time Magazine made that mistake. Baldwin should have been on the cover of Time Magazine if Time Magazine was going to do a story on contemporary American writers who are addressing themselves with some impact to the current American scene. But instead, they had it on there when they were talking about the Negro Revolution. When then you should have possibly had a Roy Wilkins or somebody who was involved.
Well, his role as writer has been tied to his polemical work.
Yeah, but this only reaches an intellectual kind of white person who is moved by this, who has a great deal of guilt feeling, and who Baldwin knows well, are in a masochistic kind of mood of mind where they don't feel like they're going to do anything, but at least they will permit themselves to be ridiculed and punished.
Now, masochistic, you mean white people or Negroes now?
White people. I think a great deal of the play-up...
Is there some of that in Baldwin? He talks about the gas chamber for the American Negro. Isn't that masochistic?
No, but my point is that a great deal of the preoccupation of the white press,
yes,
for the Malcolm X or Muslim movement or Baldwin or Adam Powell is a kind of a guilt feeling and saying, well, beat me, Daddy. You know, I'm willing to be punished. I feel guilty. Of course, with the Malcolm X and some of these others, it's many white people are saying unconsciously, you know, I'm sort of sympathetic to this notion of separatism. You take the Muslims, for example. There's many a white person who's irritated about the tension and the conflict and frightened by the threats of integration of their neighborhoods and all this. And along comes a man of philosophy that says, I don't want to integrate your schools, I don't want to integrate your neighborhoods, I don't want to integrate your daughters, I'm going to get rid of crime and welfare. There's many a white person who subconsciously says, look, this isn't too bad an idea.
Let's subsidize him.
Yeah, see if we can't play this up. So instead of talking about Whitney Young and his efforts to integrate him, well, let's play up the Muslims. But this is very stupid, because the truth of the thing is that there wouldn't be 10 Negroes that would follow Malcolm X to a separate state, even if America was going to give them one, and they aren't going to do that. Africa doesn't want our welfare load any more than New York wants a welfare load. They aren't going to import them to Africa. The appeal that a Muslim has is a kind of an opportunity for a Negro who's been beaten down all day to get a vicarious pleasure out of hearing somebody cuss out white people. But the Negroes, this is not a serious...
Like the Ku Klux Klan in reverse.
That's right. It's precisely. It's the capitalizing on an exploitation of misery and despair and hopelessness. And it's very easy to demagogue.
Is there one thing more? Back to Du Bois, for instance. His talk about the great split in the American Negro psyche. On one hand, the pull toward Africa, the pull toward a mystical blackness, the pull toward the special cultural heritage. That pull, as opposed to the pull splitting him in the other direction to identify with the Western European American tradition, the Judeo-Christian tradition, even to be absorbed totally and lose his blood identity in that tradition and in that race. Now, this great split, for some Negroes, is a real, live problem right this minute. And they tell me, at least.
It's probably and more now.
Some, it's not.
It's probably more now than ever before.
How do you feel about that, personally, or in general, as an observation?
It's probably more of a dilemma now than before. Because historically...
Now, that's very interesting. The now is interesting. Now.
Yeah.
That's
just you see, in the past, 10 years ago even, 15 years ago, Negroes made very little attempt to identify with Africa. There was no real effort. In fact, they denied any real relationship. It's been only in more recent years as Africa has come into independence and all this. I think what's working here is not so much the conflict between retaining his black identity as important, for importance sake, as the feeling that unless we have this kind of group solidarity, we won't achieve the other, that this type of solidarity has been practiced by every other group in our society, minority group, the Irish, Italians, the Catholics, Jewish people did it. And so the pull is more toward this as a tactic, as a survival technique, than it is any basic, I think, conflict with do I want to worship the idols in Tanganyika, or do I want to worship Jesus Christ? I don't think it's... You see, the Negro basically has not this kind of historical contact and relationship with Africa. He's never been really that close.
He's cut off.
He's been cut off, yes.
This makes a difference. The question is what kind of difference and how much of a difference. It's a real problem, isn't it?
Well, I think that the new pride in race is a very positive thing. Because as long as a person felt that his being a Negro made him inferior or made him an object to be despised, then being a Negro was something he couldn't help but subconsciously wished he wasn't. Now, there is developing, as more Negroes attain their rights and are recognized and all this, as Africa has come up, there is this new pride in race. Now, my concern is that America move quickly enough to reward the Negro, to give him his just rights, so that this pride will not degenerate into chauvinism and into a kind of blind nationalism which he feels is necessary for survival. I think the big problem here now is to... It's part of the dilemma that the white liberal is facing, is that what the Negro is saying today to him is that you've had all of the institutions in our society have had an opportunity to do something about my plight. The churches, the businesses, labor, every other group. But you haven't done it. Now, I understand why the group who's offended, who's hurting, must say he's hurting. So the Negro has assumed the initiative. But having assumed it, he feels that he will never again turn it over to anybody else. So that white people, if they want to express their liberalism today, must accept the fact that the Negro must lead, or that the Negro will accept him either as a peer.
It's always taken.
That's right.
Power is negotiated anyway.
That's right. So that the... And in many cases, he must follow. Now, what worries me is that most white people spend their time today bemoaning the methods and the tactics that Negroes are using, sitting around evaluating what's good and what's bad and what's going to alienate and all this, instead of saying, well, I don't like the sit-ins or I don't like the blocking of traffic, so I'm going to work on the Urban League's massive Marshall Plan to get better housing and better education and better jobs.
The white man will say that.
Well, the white man is spending more time concentrating on the inconveniences and the disturbances than he is on the basic causes of the problem to begin with, the poverty, the 1 out of 4 who are out of work, the 1 out of 6 who are in poor housing, the 500,000 Negro kids between the ages of 16 and 21 who are out of work and out of school.
But you have to wonder about which day you're going to support those.
I don't think I have to make this kind of basic decision between
or. I mean this way. I mean, there are clearly, at least some people do, if it comes down to the traffic blocking and the fair opens up, or having the demonstration in the fair on particular pavilions.
Oh, well, I'm going to make it.
That's a problem of actual choice.
Yeah.
In terms of policy and, for various people.
And you'll find the responsible Negro leadership. We on some things we have endorsed, other things we have not. We certainly will not endorse, and we'll take a public position against the stall-in.
Sure.
On the other hand, we would not oppose the picketing of the Maryland Pavilion or the Mississippi Pavilion inside the fair. We have to make these kind of choices, but if 63 did nothing else for us, it said this, that no longer can we generalize about our friends and our enemies in this whole struggle. In the past, we've said Northerners are liberal and Southerners are bigoted and management is bigoted and labor is liberal. We found in the 1960s some of the most sophisticated and brutal bigots in the North and in labor as we'd ever found in the South and among management. And we found the reverse was also true.
You should have asked me. I told you earlier.
Well, actually, I was disappointed, but not too surprised. I knew that when the chips were really down, that we'd find a lot of these fair-weather friends would desert us, as long as they could express their liberalism in terms of indignation about a lynching in Mississippi. This is one thing, but when we came to moving next door to them, this was something entirely different.
End of tape one with Mr. Whitney Young. See tape 2.